Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled Building Ethically Healthy Organizations. We want to welcome all of our guests here this evening. We invite you to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine program events which are held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker. David Gill is an ethics educator, writer, and consultant based here in the San Francisco area. He received his bachelor's degree from UC Berkeley, his master's degree from San Francisco State, and his PhD from USC. He is currently a visiting professor of business ethics on the MBA faculty at St. Mary's College in Moraga. He also teaches MBA ethics courses occasionally at the University of San Francisco and Seattle Pacific University. He has served as a business and organizational ethics consultant and trainer for a number of companies here in the Bay Area and including abroad. He has lectured on ethics at the university in France and in a number of other international locations. He's been a plenary lecturer or conference speaker for many professional groups, including here at the Commonwealth Club once before. He's delivered research papers at academic societies and associations. He's written a number of books, in addition to his current book, which is available for sale at the back of the room there. It's About Excellence is his current book, Building Ethically Healthy Organization. He's also authored or been the editor of 6 previous books on ethics, religion, and higher education. He's published more than 200 chapters, articles, and reviews in various books and journals and magazines, and he has been a regular columnist on benchmark ethics in the bi-monthly ethics bulletin. Will you please join me in welcoming David Gill?
Thank you very much. When Tom Waller invited me to come over and speak here to the business group at the Commonwealth Club, he asked me, now, would you like to speak to hundreds of people and be on TV. And I said, Tom, what I really would like you to do is find me the 20 most significant community and business leaders you can for today and the future and try to get them together and let me share my ideas with them. So I'd like to congratulate all of you for being in that position, and I look forward to sharing my ideas with you. Getting a little long in the tooth, actually, but a lot of experience teaching ethics, and that is what I want to share with you tonight, is what I've learned about trying to work toward more ethical organizations, ethical businesses. So my book is at the back, and I'd love to sell you a copy. I'm selling you the copies at my price, so $10 a pop, and I think if you want the longer version of what it's all about, what I'm going to be talking about tonight, that's it. And I also have a free monthly zine that I send out to anybody who's interested. With it's about 1,300 or 1,400 business leaders and my former MBA students, like Bo Correa I see here tonight. So I'd be happy to put you on my distribution list, also, and easy opt-out features if it gets to you at some point and you want to, limit the number of emails that you're getting. But anyway, I'm grateful to be here and thank Tom Waller and the Commonwealth Club for inviting me. So what I want to say, first of all, is how has business ethics, or how has organizational ethics been normally approached in our marketplace today? So let's call this Ethics and Compliance 1.0. Okay, this is the way things normally get handled. So an ethics problem appears. Now, why is it considered a problem? Normally, it's not because people's ethical antenna are being sensitized to this, but it's because there's some kind of litigation that's threatened, and that's what puts this on the agenda, and an indictment and possible dollar cost here, or a brand tarnishing scandal. So here are some examples. Joe is allegedly or really harassing Jane in the workplace, or there's a big oil company that's got a chemical leak and there's some kind of hazardous waste happening, or somebody, let's just call her Hillary, is passed over for a promotion, or old-timer jobs are offshore. So that's what happens is you get problems like this that get people's attention. And then what happens? Well, we call in the Ethics Emergency Service at that point. And this is what I would call damage control ethics. The problem occurs, and then we try to figure out how can we contain the damage? How can we stop the bleeding and limit the negative fallout? So we've got these problems, and how do we approach these things? Well, usually the way ethics is approached and taught in organizations and in MBA programs is, first of all, we teach a method like this. You need to get real clear on the facts, like did Joe really harass Jane or whoever? Do we have evidence? Do we have documentation? Things like that. We need to get real clear on what the law says, because this thing's going to probably get litigated. Then often in these MBA courses and in company organizational ethics programs, there's some kind of help that's looked for from a moral philosophy of one type or another. So often people learn a kind of basic introduction to Immanuel Kant and John Stuart Mill, utilitarianism. John Rawls is the most influential modern thinker. So generally speaking, we recognize a problem. We try to clarify the facts and the legal kind of side to this and appeal to some kind of philosophical program. And then we try to resolve the case. And then maybe what we do is create some new policy and training on this issue. So, for example, at St. Mary's College and most academic institutions, we have problems of sexual harassment, you know, which was one of the issues that I mentioned or I had up on the screen a moment ago. But what happens then is there's an attempt to resolve these individual cases. And then if it gets bad enough litigation and financial costs, what we do is create training programs. So every year, every faculty member and staff member at St. Mary's College is required to go through a half day or so of sexual harassment training. I always say I'm an expert in sexual harassment after years and years of being trained in the subject, you know. But the problem with this kind of thing is that it's too narrow. That's my problem with this. It's too narrow. It focuses on single episodes and issues, and it's reactive in the sense that it's seeing ethics as being something that responds only to problems, and it's negative. It tends to be something where it's all about figuring out who to blame, who to punish, who to fire, how to stop this particular problem. I want to give you some examples, some metaphors. I often think in kind of metaphorical terms. I don't know why. Maybe I read too much Aristotle or something, but I like this way of thinking about life. I think most things that are true in all areas of our life in one way or another, and most truths and most ethics are a fairly simple thing when you get right down to it. But let's say we're looking at a map of the Mississippi River here, and let's say down in New Orleans we have a problem. The problem is that you can't drink the water, you can't scoop out some water and drink it, you can't eat the fish that come out of the river right there because they're contaminated. Well, one way to respond to those problems would be to start a kind of water purification process and kind of pull the water out and try to add some chemicals and, you know, things like that to purify it as much as possible. There are these processes. With the fish, you could try to decontaminate them and at least get some cat food out of it, you know, and make the best of a bad situation. But this is what I call damage control. This would be a damage control thing. And a much better approach, from my point of view, is to go up to Memphis or go up to Moline or, you know, St. Louis or Moline or even up to Minneapolis would be best of all in the Twin Cities and say, what do we need to put into this river? How do we need to treat this river so that at the end of the process it comes out clean with some healthy fish jumping around? Here's another example, another metaphor, our own physical health. You ask, how do we take care of our health? Well, one way to take care of our health is to go to the doctor when we're sick. Go to the doctor in the hospital, check in when we've had a problem that needs to be resolved. And a lot of people actually are like that. The only time they go to the doctor, I'm a little bit like that. You go to the doctor only when, you know, you really got a problem and you get it bandaged, you know, you get it fixed up, you get some drugs to take care of that. But the other side of healthcare is to say, why don't we spend more time building healthy bodies? Why don't we work on our nutrition and our exercise and our flexibility and our rest patterns and life balance and that type of thing? So building ethically healthy bodies and lifestyles. So you can see where I'm going with this is I think in organizations we need to move to that kind of an approach, where instead of ethics being the ethics police and the emergency force coming in to cope with a problem and limit damage, what we do is really build organizations that are less likely to have those problems to begin with. Now, one of the things that I need to say before looking at this slide with you here and seeing what's the next step is we also have to realize that in life there are no guarantees. So you can go to the gym every day, you know, and work out and eat right and everything else, and you can still step off the curb and get hit by a truck. So there are no guarantees. And in organizations, we can do everything right in terms of building more ethically healthy organizations, but that doesn't mean that we are immune from a scandal or a problem or something that's driven by market pressures or conflicts or who knows what. So there are no guarantees, but just like in the case of our health, if we would work at our health, we're more likely to stay healthy, more likely to avoid falling on the ground, you know, and stumbling if we stay a little bit healthier and that type of thing. So here's where I would suggest, first of all, we go with those things, is instead of just seeing problems and responding to problems, we deepen it by moving from problems to what we'll call practices. So every specific episode and dilemma that comes up is related to some business practice. So, for example, for Joe harassing Jane is really about a practice of communication. It's about how people communicate and relate in the workplace. Or in the case of Big Oil, it's not just about a chemical leak, but thinking more broadly about how do we as a business relate to the environment? How do we exercise our stewardship? Or in the case of Hillary, we need to talk about, well, how do we approach leadership and evaluation and promotion and preparing people for these kinds of decisions? And old-timer jobs offshore, and how do we approach issues of employee retention and development and contracts and assumptions about people and management and their tenure in these places? So what we're talking about are practices, business practices, not just problems. We're talking about taking a deeper look and trying to say, what are our practices? In other words, how do we spend our time in this organization? And so what I do with organizations is I urge them not just to make a list of the big problems they face, but let's map out how do we spend our time here. In fact, I lead organizations to have all the employees make a kind of list of how do I spend my time during the week at this organization. You know, I'm answering the phone, I'm answering email, I'm creating widgets in my workshop or whatever it is, but we map out how we spend our time, whether that's in aspects of marketing or HR or research, accounting, things like that. And then what we do is we get the people involved in trying to identify guidelines for those practice areas. So we say, we're spending all of our time doing these things, but how should we do the things we do? How do we create a positive code of ethics and conduct or a set of guidelines that keep our practices on track? And so the target here is in our organization to have what I call principle-guided practices. Now, how do you do this? Well, this is a blaze of type, and this reminds me to say, if you will give me your business card or email me, I will send you my slides. Okay, so you can go back and have a look at this. But also, like I said, in my book, I have a lot of detailing out of, you know, this kind of thing, a kind of manual on how to do this kind of thing. But, you know, in an organization, then how do you create a code of ethics that really is going to work? Not just something that's going to be a document that gets filed away in the back of a file cabinet, but actually helps people. It's like I say on the second item here, it's a map, and it's directions on how to get to our destination. Well, we all know that just having a map isn't going to help us if we don't put it in the car and use it, you know, so we've got to make these maps so they're accurate, they're up to date, and they really are helpful and usable. So there are a lot of reasons why we should, you know, work on developing, you know, good codes of ethics. I'm not going to talk about all of that. But I will say a couple words about who does this thing. And in my experience, this isn't going to work if the leaders and the managers in an organization aren't behind it. So there are a lot of articles, a lot of literature today about tone at the top. And most organizations that are ethically healthy, it's because they have CEOs and leaders who really care about these things. Now, it's hard to build stronger ethics in an organization if the people at the top don't care about it. It's not impossible to do it in your unit that you're working in or your particular work team. You can make life a lot better for yourselves in your direct reports and your colleagues if you work at it. But, of course, what we would really love is to see people at the top really get behind this kind of thing. So leaders and managers have a role. And then people like me have a role sometimes, most of the time, in an organization to have ethics and compliance experts, people who've done a lot of this thing, come in and help organizations do this. But the thing that I emphasize most when I'm working with an organization is the third thing here, the third under the who, is the role of the practitioners. Because I think in writing a code of ethics, if you're writing a set of ethical guidelines for salespeople, who are the people in your organization who know best where the temptations could come or where the problems could come in the life of a salesperson? And the answer is the salespeople do. They know where the temptations are. They know where the problems could occur. So my approach is always, let's get the salespeople to write the ethical guidelines for salespeople and not have some outside experts or wordsmiths from the communication department write these things. And what you get out of that is you get expertise. You get the expertise of the actual practitioners. And secondly, you get ownership because they wrote it, and so they're going to own it. Whereas if you try to impose it as a kind of external thing, it's not going to have the same kind of power. And the way I do this always is I always ask the practitioners, I put it kind of like this. I say, look, if it was just you, I would have confidence in you knowing how to do your job. Okay, you've been here for a while. I have confidence in you. But after all, we hope this company is going to be growing and we're going to be expanding. And so we don't always have you around to explain to everybody how to do things. We're going to be hiring new people in your work area, maybe for our branch office out there. So could you help us write some guidelines for the new people who are going to come on board in your work area? And when you put it that way and structure it that way, psychologically, people buy into it. And you get ownership and you get expertise in that way. So mapping the practices and articulating guidelines, I do also ask the practitioners, what are the kinds of problems that come up in your work area, and could you write some guidelines that will help people avoid those problems? Okay, well, writing it is only the first thing. The second aspect to this is how do you implement this and actually get the map out, you know, get the MapQuest technology out and actually start using this thing. Well, this is a whole other challenge, is how to keep this thing from disappearing into the back of a file cabinet and actually be part of the organizational life. So there's a lot of stuff that needs to happen here in terms of not just putting it in print, but making it available online. In all organizations that I work at, I coach people a lot on writing articles about cases that come up, trying to explain what's going on as far as the code requirements are concerned, giving examples from the people's lives, mentioning names, episodes in the company's life so that people are actually eager to read these newsletters because they might read about some colleague they know. So it's getting the real people stuff involved in the communication and training. But now, a comment I want to really focus on here is on this training bit in the middle here. And what's happened is that most of the time in most organizations, especially big organizations, what you have is the second kind of training, or the online training packages, where people, like my wife worked for Citibank for 20 years and did a lot of training. And what they do is they have you're required to get in front of your computer screen, and when you can carve out 30 minutes or an hour to go through this tutorial, it's your ethics training for the year. And so you have to go through these episodes and kind of choose the right answer in the multiple choice questions, and then you can advance to a slide, and finally at the end, you know, you're checked out and you can get your certificate, or at least it goes into your file, and that type of thing. Now, what's great about this, of course, is it's scalable. In other words, you can do this for a company of 500, and you can kick it up to 15,000 employees with very little increase in price. It's asynchronous, meaning everybody doesn't have to do it at the same time. So you find a spot in your schedule when you can work that in. That's very convenient. It's efficient. The problems with this kind of training, though, which is done everywhere, is that it's individualistic and it's oversimplified. Now, what I mean by that is that it really is teaching people. You know, the medium is part of the message. The medium is part of the message. And so you remember Marshall McLuhan saying that. But the technology itself and the way we teach is part of the teaching lesson itself. And so basically what this stuff is saying, it's saying, oh, it's ethics time, go and sit by yourself and think for yourself. But what we should be teaching is, it's ethics time, go find a colleague and talk about this. Because ethics is a team sport, not a solo sport. Ethics, by its nature, is something that benefits by us talking with one another. And so we need, in our education and training, we need to have things that say, it's ethics time, let's get together and beat on this problem and see what we come up with. The other thing is that online training is oversimplified. Now, no matter how many bells and whistles and how exciting and interesting the graphics can be, and they can be really jazzy these days. I've been looking at some Cisco stuff that is just mind-boggling how interesting and fun it is. The problem is that no matter how interesting and fun it is technologically, the fact is you have to pick the right letter on the multiple choice option to get the slide to advance, to get the program to advance. You cannot build in the fact that in an actual real-life ethics problem, we're going to disagree, we're going to muddle through. Sometimes we're going to say, I think we ought to hold off. Let's buy some time. Or we'll accommodate it. And when we walk out of the room, we're all going to say, you know, I don't really agree with, I don't think that's the best way to do it. But nevertheless, it is the best way for an organization to approach things, is to muddle through in community, in a sense, to build teams. It's just like, think of all the literature today on the wisdom of teams, the power of, the wisdom of we, the power of we. You know, in all areas of business life today, we're emphasizing its teams, its interaction, it's a collaborative enterprise to think about mergers and acquisitions. Well, let me tell you, ethics is a collaborative enterprise, and we need each other's wisdom. So what do? Well, we can't get rid of these things. We don't want to get rid of online training. We need online training for all the reasons that we saw before. It's scalable, efficient, et cetera. But what I urge organizations to do, even if they have 50,000 employees, is we need to have some face-to-face training. Now, part of that is mentoring. When people are new employees, they ought to have mentors in the organization who help walk them through. That's really the best kind of training, is to be have somebody who you're kind of walking alongside of who says, look, here's how we approach an issue like that and to do that. But I also think group training. In the organization that I work with most these past recent months is Harris & Associates out in Concord. We invent a two-hour training program. And they have 500 employees. They're spread around in 12 regional offices. But we try to set this thing up so that everybody in the company is challenged to give 2 hours. Now, 2 hours out of a year? You know, give me a break. Everybody ought to be able to give 2 hours to a group meeting with 15 to 20 people where they beat on certain issues and kind of discuss what's going on in the company. But, you know, I find companies where they say, it's no way. You know, there's no way that we can do even 2 hours. I'm talking with a company based in Luxembourg, actually, right now, and they have 1,500 employees, and we made a proposal to them, and so it's kind of interesting to see how they're reacting to this. But what I say to them and other companies is, well, look, if you can't get everybody together in a special ethics training session, then here's the next best thing, and actually this could be equally good, is I'll help you and your managers write some modules that will take 15 minutes to 30 minutes with a case and some concepts that are really critical to a healthy culture and ethics in your company. And let's send them out to all the managers and say, we would like you in the next 2 months to find a 15-minute window of time or a 30-minute window of time with your staff meeting. And so bring it up in your staff meeting and carve out 15 minutes or 30 minutes preferably to go over this thing. So in a sense, you train the trainers but diffuse it through the organization in that sense. So yeah, mentoring is best. Group training is great. But that kind of, let's put the module in the staff meeting. So the existing team meetings put a module. And I think that helps get us a long way toward the kind of face-to-face ethics training. So anyway, so we're talking about practices. We're talking about principles encapsulated in a code of ethics. Okay. Now, here's the next step in building ethically healthy organizations. You can't just have a great code and great ethics training without paying attention to culture. Okay, culture is who we are. It's who we are. So practices are what we do, and culture is what we be. Culture is what we be. I always tell my students, you know, it's not all about what we do, and it's not all about what we be, but it's do-be-do-be-do is the way it really works, is you have to have an interaction between your practices in life and in an organization and the culture. The culture is who we are. It's what enables or disables what we do. Now, the way I approach culture, this is what I've learned, is there's a lot of literature on corporate culture today. My problem with some of it, I guess that's why I'm a professor. I always have a problem with everything, so I always want to do it better and things like that, and you know that people are going to revise what I do and do it differently too. But, you know, that's part of the quest and part of the excitement is always to try to figure out how can we do it better for our generation in the business world. So anyway, the way I look at this thing is actually goes back to when I was an undergraduate at Cal, and I wasn't an ethics student so much as a history student. And I was really interested in social history and cultural history in those days. So I took some anthropology and sociology courses, and I learned in those courses how does an anthropologist study a new culture? What are you looking for when you find a new culture that's living in some far-off place that's maybe been detached from civilization or a bunch of Berkeley hippies who disappeared into the mountains in the 60s? What would you look at when you come upon this group of people in a clearing? Well, my argument is, based on Malinowski and these other anthropologists, is you'd really look at four things. First of all, you'd look at their physical structure. How do they? What kind of houses do they live in? How do they configure their villages and things like that? Because the physical side of an organization or a community is embedded with values. Like right now, the way you're seating is really embedded with values, and the value says, hey, there's one guy worth listening to in the room. You know, because you're all kind of faced forward in a very military type thing. But there's values here. If we were all sitting in a circle, it'd be saying, Gil, why don't you keep quiet and let some of these other people talk? So the way we configure our buildings, our offices, the kind of technology platform that we have, the kind of automobiles we have in our company fleet, all of those things are embedded with values. That's level one of a culture. Number two is the organizational structure and policies. All cultures have policies and organizational charts, you might say. And those things are embedded with values. Just to give you a simple example is a compensation budget. That compensation budget tells you a lot about what the organization values. They value the top 10 people in the organization and not so much others, or do they value everybody in a very powerful way? The salary schedule is embedded with values. Are all of your compensation policies oriented towards individual achievement, or do you reward teams with bonuses? So you see, the compensation plan is embedded with some of those values. And then your personnel. The fact is, if you have teamwork as one of your core values, but you're hiring people without asking them questions about how do you like working on teams and how have you done when you were given an individual project and sent off to do it all by yourself, you know, and how do you feel like you're most successful? And how do you deal with difficult people? Can you tell me an example about that? So interviewing people about these values, you want to be sure that your personnel, that their personal character is in alignment with the kind of corporate culture. In Built to Last, the most best-selling business, most influential business book of the 1990s, Built to Last by Jim Collins and Jerry Porras, a couple Stanford professors, they have a chapter called Cult-Like Cultures. And they talk about how important it is to hire for cultural fit. And in Jim Collins' new book, Good to Great, which I think is probably the best-selling management book of this millennium so far, it's on the business bestseller list all the time in the Wall Street Journal. Anyway, he has a thing in there where he talks about getting the right people on the bus. Get the right people on the bus and get the wrong people off the bus. Now, nobody is really wrong or without value, but the question is, are they on the right bus for them to flourish and for the bus to be in good shape for where it wants to go? So personnel is a critical thing. And the fourth thing is the informal culture. That's the rituals, the ambiance, the kind of parties and things that you do or how you dress and, you know, things like that, the Walmart cheers and the Toyota calisthenics and all this kind of stuff, you know. It's IBM's, old culture was, you know, the blue suit, you know, that kind of thing, and Apple's more hip and, you know, open and things like that. So there is an importance to that informal culture. The ambiance is very important. The problem is that today's corporate culture writers spend too much time talking about that stuff and not enough time talking about how our core values need to be embedded in the physical structures, the organizational policies and stuff, and in our personnel. So what we're really looking for is, what are the core values in our organization, the core characteristics that will help us build the culture in order to carry out our practices in a successful way. So our target here is a value-embedded culture, is the way we like to talk about this. So the core values, you know, what we need to do is identify the handful of key characteristics that are crucial to the achievement of our company mission and vision. And here again, it's like when we're writing the code of ethics, I think you've got to have the practitioners play a lead role. By the way, another example of that is Wikipedia. Almost all of us, when we do a search, we get a Wikipedia Wikipedia article on something. And it's, you know, there have been studies done that show that Wikipedia is just as accurate, it's been fact-checked, it's just as accurate as the Encyclopedia Britannica, even though it's the people who are involved in a mass collaboration to write these things. It's a phenomenal thing. And it teaches us something. In fact, on the back of my book, the guy who wrote Wikonomics wrote a blurb on the back of my book saying, I like Gill's book because it's kind of a wiki ethics approach, because I talk about getting the people involved. And I've recommended to some organizations, let's post the code of ethics on the intranet in this company, and let's open it up. And for a month, let's tell the people, we'd like you to work on our code of ethics and improve it, and let's see what happens. See what happens. I would believe that it probably would only get better if we did things like that. So anyway, but now when it comes to the culture and the core values, here I'm not so much a wiki guy as I am a management guy, in the sense that I would say you need to have the culture tenders and culture builders play a central role in figuring out what are the core values here. What I mean by that is the managers, you know, that type of thing. So you want to have all the people in the organization play into this and buy it, but it's people who are managing groups that ought to be the main people who will say, you know what a critical factor is here for my team to succeed is a focus on teamwork or respect or integrity or whatever it is. So again, embedding those values in all four levels. Here's an example of a company that I mentioned before that I've worked with a lot. So down the left-hand side here, you can see the six core values that the management team, about 60 managers in Harrison Associates, this is a construction and project management firm, mostly consulting engineers out in Concord. They're really an incredibly successful, excellent company. And they identified those six things, integrity, quality, reliability, respect, teamwork, and fun, as their six premier values that have made their company great and that they want to be sustaining features of their culture. Those are their core values. And then across the top, you can see there's a physical, organizational, personnel, and informal label up there. So the question is that I have for them is, can we be sure that respect is embedded in the way this place is set up physically? You know, like in our equipment, in the way we configure the office, does this show respect that we value every person and every job? Then in the organizational policies, do we show that we respect, as we say, we respect every person and every job is important in this organization? Is there a policy side to showing that? And personnel, do we hire people to try to make sure that they have that attitude toward others? They're not just prima donnas who don't respect other people. And then do we have informal rituals? Well, let me just give you two examples. Okay, I wish I could. I'm watching that clock buzzing by. But respect, okay, well, first of all, when you walk into Harrison Associates, this is a beautiful big warehouse type thing out in Concord that's been really interestingly configured. But, you know, it really does say everybody's important when you walk in there. For example, you don't walk in and see a huge picture of Carl Harris, the founder, or Guy Erickson, the president. No, you see a wall with hundreds of pictures of the people who work in this organization. And scattered around this wall, all these are black and white, looks like Ansel Adams photographs, But scattered around, embedded in this wall, are things like these words: integrity, quality, respect. You see their core values embedded in this wall full of pictures. And you see them because they pop out because they're in red. And they have pieces of their mission and their vision statement in there. So it's all kind of embedded in these people. And the executives have their offices around the front side there, but they're not real, they're functional. And in the middle, there's a great gathering spot. They all have one cafeteria for everybody to go to. It's a company that says, let's get some work done, let's have a good time, and we bump into each other all the time. On the organizational side, last thing and then I'm moving on. I'm almost done, by the way. So on the organizational side, and Bo may remember this, one of my SAR students at St. Mary's, but the organizational side, here's what blew me away when I first started working with Harris and Associates, is I found out that when Carl Harris started this company in the 70s, he really respected other people. And so when they finally had, he started with three people, okay, but before you know it, they had 10 people and they were making some money a couple of years. So Carl Harris, founder of the company, bought a vacation home in Hawaii and went over there. He didn't buy a timeshare, he bought the vacation home over there. Okay, and what he did, though, was he realized pretty soon, well, he and Mrs. Harris couldn't spend all year in Hawaii. He had a business to run. So he said to his colleagues, look, if you'd like to use my place in Hawaii, all of them, his secretary and the other engineers, he said, look, if you'd like to use my place in Hawaii, you're free to do it. It's just you have to pay the $200 to the Merry Maids to come in and clean it up, Well, okay, now fast forward 35 years. Now there's 500 employees around the Western U.S. Carl is retired up to Idaho. But you know what? Harris and Associates owns 10 vacation properties at Whistler, Tahoe, couple islands in Hawaii, Vegas, Palm Springs. And you know what? It doesn't matter if you started there last week. At Harris, you have, as one of your perks, 1 week at a Harris vacation condo, and whether you're a vice president or sweeping floors, you pay $100 or $200 or whatever it is to have the Merry Maids come in and clean up after you. Now, you tell me that isn't a policy in an organization that says, we mean respect for everybody here. Now, of course, the VPs and they make more money. Of course they do. But it's not way out of scale. These people can afford their own vacation place. But it's an organization that builds respect into the fabric of what they do. That's how you build ethically healthy organizations where people are less likely to walk around disrespecting one another by how they talk to one another, because it starts at the top and it's embedded in every part of the organization. Now, a final topic I want to approach, though, is motivation and leadership. So how do we motivate people to want to do the kinds of deep organization building that I'm talking about? How do you do that? Well, one way to do it is through fear. You can talk about these companies that have gotten in trouble, talk about these executives who've gone to jail or these workers who stole from their organizations who go to jail. Talk about how we're going to fire you if we have you harassing and what have you around here or messing with our thing. And you can tell these stories. And so I think there's a little place for that. There's a little place for that in organizations where you have to keep it real, tell the stories about how our competitors or others have gotten in trouble. And do you want to see this company go down? You want to see your career go down? You got to be careful about crossing those lines. Be careful not to cross those lines. But, that's like I wanted, my wife is my techie help now because she's done this for generations of Citibank leaders and now I got her at home, and I want her to help my slides improve. Anyway, what I would like is a slide here that has a picture of a donkey. And at the back of the donkey right now, I want to show somebody with a stick trying to get that donkey to move. But I also want to have then another slide that has an apple or a carrot up in front of that donkey. And I want to say, what do you think is the best way to make that donkey move? And so I'm going to say passion and reward is more important than it is to have a stick warning your people they better be ethical. I'd say let's hold a carrot out there and say we could enjoy getting out of bed and coming to work here in the morning. We could really succeed. So ethics ultimately is about excellence, not just about jail avoidance or trouble avoidance. And ethics really is an account What is our company ethics about? Our company ethics is an account of how we need to treat each other, and in fact, treat all of our stakeholders. That means our competitors, government regulators, anybody who's got a stake in what's happening here. We need to figure out how do we need to treat these people in order to achieve our mission and fulfill our vision. Now, here's a very cool thing. In Aristotle and Plato in the early Greek language, the New Testament also, there's a word in Greek for moral virtue, and the word is arete. In fact, in philosophy, if you took a philosophy course, you probably heard that this ethics of character and culture and stuff is called aretaic ethics. That's the branch of moral philosophies, aretaic ethics, virtue ethics. But you know what? This is the same word as the Greek word for excellence. So excellence and ethics are the same thing. To do the right thing is the same thing, or is supposed to be the same thing, as doing things right. So you do things right in an excellent way is also to do the right thing. So it's to try to bring those two ideas back together. So here's the organization we've been talking about. It carries out its practices. It's based on its culture, right? But what we're going to say is it's motivated by trying to achieve a mission, a core purpose. What is the thing that we're trying to do? Why are we in this company instead of just working at home? You know, why do we get in our cars and transportation and come here anyway? Why don't we just stay home? Well, we've come here to do something together that we couldn't do so well by ourselves. Otherwise, we ought to stay home or go off and do it somewhere else. So we have got something we want to accomplish here, some product, some service that we want to deliver, and we want to do it better than anybody else. We want to deliver it. And that's our target. That's why we're carrying out these practices. That's why we're building this culture. And then our vision is what we will look like when our mission succeeds, and our target there is excellence. So this is the ethics and compliance 2.0 story. You know, we need to troubleshoot these crisis cases and dilemmas, but move on from damage control to mission control, from problem containment to organization building. This is an approach that's holistic rather than narrow. It's proactive instead of reactive. It's positive instead of negative. Oh, my last slide. Anyway, thank you very much.
Okay, David, well, thank you so much for a terrific overview there and some great insights. And we'll move into the Q&A period now. I just want to remind our audience, we're listening to David Gill talk to us about building ethically healthy organizations. So we'll be asking audience for questions in just a second. I guess I'll lead off with a question that says, if we cut to the chase about human nature, can we not say that everybody essentially wants to do the right thing? And if not, what seems to get in the way in our various organizations, be they for-profits, be they not-for-profits, you know, any organizational, in other words, grouping of people coming together to accomplish something, what is it that seems to get in the way of just doing the right thing?
I do think that most people, I would say all people have a moral compass within them. All people have a conscience, you know, and a kind of moral set of standards in some way. Now, we disagree about aspects of that. There are books about the evolution of morality and, you know, about how we've evolved into moral animals and why, you know, it's part of our social herd instinct. And, of course, there's a whole history of theological literature about how God has implanted, his law in our hearts and things like that. Well, I think this is true. And I would always appeal to people's higher values and nature, and I think a lot of times people respond to that. So we need business leaders and cultural leaders and community leaders and presidential candidates who appeal to the best side of us instead of drilling fear into us and trying to bring out sometimes play on the worst side of our life. So I agree with what you're saying. But the problem is that life is so complicated, isn't it? And just to give you one example, sometimes people do the wrong thing for the right reason. So they'll do a bad thing, an ethically bad thing, but because they were motivated by wanting to do the right thing. So I know when, well, I guess I should be careful about mentioning names, so maybe I will. But anyway, a software company was being stalked by a gorilla software company here in the Bay Area. I mean, gorilla, not gorilla. I mean, this was a major, huge firm that was trying to take over a smaller one. Well, it turned out that the smaller company, which had these wonderful work relationships and things like that, they were publicly traded, so they were vulnerable, and this big company wanted to take them over, and the CEO said publicly, it was in the papers all the time, we want to take you over not because we want any of your people. As a matter of fact, we're going to lay the most of them off. We don't actually care about your technology. We think ours is better. What we want is your customer list, and we think we can do a better job, and so we're coming after you. Well, it turned out, after they succeeded in this, that the final president, CEO of this company that was being stalked, was indicted for cooking the books. But the reason why he was cooking the books was to try to make things look better to save off the stalker. So sometimes people do that. So that's one reason why what we want to do is build strong cultures. And those cultures need to have transparency in them so that people are not off in a corner being driven to things like that. When people have high-stakes problems, we need to build accountability and support for one another. So I think a lot of it, Tom, really is because of that the problems are so complex that sometimes we do that as the least of all evils instead of finding the greatest good.
And sometimes I would imagine that the pressures of business success and so forth, in other words, the temptation of taking the shortcut, I mean, we could enumerate, I guess, a long list of things that perhaps, as I was asking, get in the way. And
also I shouldn't paper over the fact that greed is a very addictive thing. And I recently watched this movie again, Wall Street. And what was that other movie we were watching? It was about stock traders.
Boiler Room.
Anyway, these people are just mad with desire to take people's money from them. No matter what, they'll lie, cheat, and steal, or walk over their grandmother's grave or something, So, I mean, there's no doubt about the fact that this is a drug as addictive. Power and wealth can be an incredible drug. Yeah. Why don't you say this in the microphone.
Oh, yeah. In social psychology, they talk about groupthink.
Yeah.
And it's a phenomena where people tend to lose their individuality within a group.
Yeah.
So do you have any suggestions on how to, keep it in an organization from falling prey to groupthink?
Yeah, well, I think, groupthink is a bad way to talk about it, but a strong culture is a good way to talk about it. So there's no doubt about the fact that bad people will do better things if they're surrounded by a team. Like, there are football players, for example, who are total egomaniacs with terrible addictions, and yet sometimes they'll kind of come on board and not be so disruptive because their teammates can pressure them. Like the Oakland A's are legendary. I don't know what's happening now, but they're legendary for creating this kind of team chemistry where bad boys behave themselves. You know what I mean? Where there are other teams where they don't have that kind of culture, and these guys just kind of go nuts and disrupt everything. So I think sometimes cultures can pull people up, and sometimes they drag people down. And that's why what we have to say is, what are the core values that are really critical, and how can we embed those in the way we do things?
So do you think Adam Smith was ethical or unethical?
No, I think Adam Smith actually was very ethical. He wrote a book called The Theory of the Moral Sentiments about 15 years before he wrote The Wealth of Nations. And so Adam Smith, in fact, believed that you can't have the invisible hand of the marketplace, in other words, where people are just pursuing their own self-interest, independently of a morally sensitized population. And so I believe, taken in context, I think Adam Smith really was on our side of the side of the angel, so to speak, wanting really people to make money and unleash that ambition and creativity and innovation. We want to unleash that and have business development, but we want to do it in a way where we're saying, I want in my victory and my gain, I want all my stakeholders to gain. So I want my customers to have a great experience from doing business with this company, as well as my employees. And in fact, my competitors ought to be better off as a result of the fact that we exist. Sir?
Well, good. On an imaginary timeline, I'm curious to know how young you were when you got interested in this key word, ethics. Was it junior high school? And then in terms of the present, what are you feeling with regard to the future, that your message is being well received? Are you optimistic that there's an audience out there that wants to hear what you've got to say?
Starting with the last part of that first, thank you for the great question. But I think that basically human history tends to go in cycles a bit, but, you know, pretty much there are, I think there's a kind of constant battle, you know, in all of us as individuals and in our culture. And sometimes things are a little more comfortable and sometimes a little less comfortable, a little more violent, a little less. But, you know, we're never going to really achieve a kind of utopia. You know, the word utopia means nowhere, you know. So I think there are more and more businesses now that are looking at things like the triple bottom line is a common way of talking about it, that says that we will have no successful business in a society that is falling apart. We cannot have sustainable financial success if the environment is burning out and being polluted. So the triple bottom line says that it's people, profits, and planet together, or it's nothing. Now, you could do a short-term business thing where maybe you can score some financial victories and get out, and somebody else will clean up after you. But less and less is that going to be a possibility. So there's a lot of that kind of talk. Now, me personally, I grew up in a very rabid, passionate Christian family. Okay, but my family that I grew up in taught me when I was a little kid that, you know, little David, you need to do the right thing, you know, and when you're collecting on your newspaper route, you better be sure you're delivering some good service and things like that. And my dad was an accountant here at Crown Zeller back at, One Bush Street, it used to be before they were taken over in a hostile takeover and the company was killed. But that was a couple years after my dad left. But still, you know, my dad was a businessman who set this example, and I lived in a family where I remember when I was when the San Francisco Giants moved here in 1958. I was 12 years old and a paper boy, and I remember reading that Willie Mays, who was the star of the Giants at that time, was denied buying a house in Pacific Heights or something over here because he was black. And I remember saying to my dad then, because we were baseball fans, we'd come over to Seal Stadium here to watch the Giants that first couple years. I remember saying, you know, what is this? I mean, if there's anybody on earth who I'd like to better to have as my next door neighbor, it'd be Willie Mays. So my dad, you know, taught me about racism, things like that. Said, you know, as followers of the God who created everybody, we don't have that attitude. It's wrong. It's wrong. I don't care what people think. It's wrong to discriminate against Jewish people or black people or anybody. So, you know, I grew up in that kind of atmosphere where we were talking about that kind of thing, and it was just like, it doesn't matter what everybody else is. You're the man. You know, you stand up in your among your school friends. So then here's the next phase was, I'm an undergraduate at Berkeley in the 60s. So when I got out of San Leandro High School, I went to Cal. In the fall of 64, the free speech movement began, and my whole career at Cal as an undergraduate was demonstrations and chaos and the Vietnam War and all that kind of stuff. I've often said since then that I have a hard time studying and writing unless I can smell tear gas, because in my mind, in my experience, they're so closely associated. I've also said, by the way, just my other recollection here is, you know, Bill Clinton has been quoted and said, you know, that he smoked a joint one time but didn't inhale. You remember that? He smoked a joint but didn't inhale. Well, what I've said oftentimes is I never smoked a joint, but I inhaled all the time. Because just walking around Berkeley, you were inhaling, you know. So anyway, that's. But during that time, here's what happened. All my moral structure, you know, that I was raised with in the kind of Ozzie and Harriet 50s and 60s, you know, all of a sudden, all that stuff is in question. Because now it's the Black Panthers talking about issues in a much deeper way than just Willie Mays moving in next door. They're talking about deep structures and questions in Oakland, where I'm living, you know. And here's the Vietnam thing, and so I'm asking, what's the right thing? You know, what's the right thing? And Ralph Nader's coming along, and feminism, and all these questions are being raised. And so that's when I gravitated toward the study of ethics, because I decided, you know, I want to spend my life trying to figure out what's the right thing to do. What's the right thing to do? And so, you know, it's been a great life and a great career. And I just find that people are interested in it. They sometimes get exhausted. There's such a thing as kind of moral exhaustion, you know, as we look at all these issues. But, you know, it really is, it's not just about beating on each other. It's also about human joy and relationships. And we can't just be discouraged because things are not perfect. It's about muddling through, having a little celebration along with the difficulties. Jim.
Dr. Gill, when I was writing over on BART, I read this article in the current Newsweek. it's about a company, a multi-level marketing company that prides itself in having 1 million people that work for the company that are selling the product. And it's a multi-level marketing. And so I'm a little difficult in asking a question on this, but it says that more than 90% are considered wholesale customers. In other words, they only qualify to get a discount on the drink that the company is selling. And then it says that fewer than 1% qualified for a commission, and of those, only 10% made more than $100 a week. So you can do the arithmetic as you come down in this. Now, is there a role for pointing out unethical behavior in a company, or does one let one sort of collapse from within? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I mean, this seems like an unethical company, and it just does. But
we need. When you look, people have studied what happened with Enron, and basically what's happened is, you know, we look at this and say, well, yeah, Ken Lay and Jeff Skilling and Andrew Fastow and these leaders, they really have a large burden of guilt for what happened there. But also their board of directors, it was a Stanford faculty member from the business school, straight arrow guy, who actually made the motion to suspend the rules and allow Andy Fastow to create those phony organizations. So even a good person can be blind and foolish. It was Arthur Anderson. You know, this company with a stellar reputation until they did their waste management scandal and a few other things just before Enron. But, you know, they had decades of a rep, but they blew it, and they would not call these people on the carpet. The regulators let it down. The attorneys, the financial analysts who refused to put a no-buy recommendation on Enron stock. They kept encouraging people to, like lambs to the slaughter the whole way. And then the journalists. So the answer, I think, Jim, is we all need to be vigilant. So as customers, we need to decide, am I walking in and going to patronize this place? No, they may not miss my money, but I'll tell you something. I do not fly United Airlines anymore because of how they treat their flight attendants and mechanics and bailed out on their pension commitments while the CEO is still raking in millions and millions and millions of dollars in bonuses. I fly Southwest, and where they have a wholly different approach. And by the way, they're the only profitable airline, and they've been profitable 35 years in a row without missing a quarter. But they don't operate that way, and I don't care if I have to change planes in 3 airports to get from here to Chicago. I'm going to fly Southwest and not United. So, what does United care? Well, they haven't written me any letters begging me to come back, believe me. But it's writing articles, it's protesting, we have to have journalists. We want to hope that there'll be some people who are rabble-rousers who will keep these things on the agenda. So, you know, it's just all of us kind of doing what we can where we are. But yes, there is a role, and we have to hope that we have people who call attention to these things. Yes.
I'm curious about your perception about the motivation of the companies who come to you for consultation. Is your observation that the majority of them initially are dealing with you out of a more damage control orientation, or that they have a broader picture of what they're trying to achieve? Or?
Yeah, good question. So why do these companies, why would I get business, why would somebody hire me to help them do it? In the case of the Harris Company, which is the star company in illustrating a lot of these concepts in my book back there, which I've been working with for about 4 years pretty intensively, their motivation was, we've got a great thing going here, but you know what? Carl Harris is retired. The current leadership is getting up in their 60s and is going to be retiring before you know it. And also, we used to be in Concord and Los Angeles. Now we've got branch offices in Seattle, Stockton, you know, Reno, Salt Lake City. And so how can we make sure we keep this thing going? How can we keep this thing great? So that's why they were motivated, is how can we stay great? How can we keep this thing alive? This is, if you read, you know, Max Weber, the great German sociologist, father of sociology, at least in German Germany. But Weber wrote a lot about the sociology of organizations, and he said, you know, in the initial phase, organizations and movements start because of a charismatic individual, usually. In other words, it's a person, an individual, who has a great idea, and people gather around. And as long as that person is there, their values, you know, really impact the people who are attracted to that company. But Weber did a lot of study of what happens when the charismatic leader dies or leaves. How do you, what is that transition point? And that's where Weber talked about the routinization of charisma. And what he meant by that was, how do you create a learning framework and a kind of culture that perpetuates those values? It's not as good, it's not as dynamic in some ways as to have the man or the woman, you know, there. But on the other hand, it will keep it going. It's just like David Packard and Bill Hewlett in HP. After about 30 years, it got so big that they couldn't make hamburgers for all 600 of their employees. They couldn't know them all by name, so they went away and wrote down their basic principles and summarized it in the HP way. And so from then on, until Carly, everybody read the HP way and tried to follow that. And then, you know, now they're working it adapting it for a new generation. So so that's one thing. But there are other organizations that are in, like this company I was mentioning in Europe that I'm talking to right now. They don't have big problems, but they can see problems looming. It's a younger startup. They have 1,500 employees scattered around the continents. And so they're saying, can you help us train people? We've got a code of ethics. Can you help us train people? There are others where there have been problems. I'm just at a company down in Santa Clara where the people were, you know, really, you know, at a loss to how to overcome some real cultural problems in the organization. So it varies widely why people are interested. I would say, by the way, that in about 1994, there was some new legislation passed giving federal sentencing guidelines for white-collar crime, business crime, the U.S. federal sentencing guidelines. And one of the provisions was that judges and juries have the option of reducing penalties for white-collar crime, business crime, by up to 40% if the company could demonstrate that they had in place an ethics training program. So overnight, the Fortune 1000 companies wrote codes of ethics and put in place at least half-hearted efforts at ethics training. But the problem is, so, you know, that's not really very high-minded motivation. But the problem is that most of these things were invented by philosophers or lawyers, and they which I love philosophers and lawyers, but nevertheless, there's a much, I think that the key insights don't come from philosophers and lawyers. They come from the people, and they come from community leaders. They come from parents who've tried to teach their kids how to be a good kid, you know, and how to teach kids. And you know what? You know how we've got two kids who are now 37 and 36. But you know, why are those kids? Why do they have a work ethic? Why do they feel honest? Why do you know more or less, as far as we can tell, all the time? But you know, why are people like that? I'll tell you why. It's because my wife, sitting back there, and me too, I think, when these kids were little, you know, and we would see a kid or you know a lady on the street begging, that type of thing. Our kids would say, why is that lady over there sitting there with her baby begging, something like that? And we'd say, well, she's had a hard time. She doesn't have much to eat. And so we'd say, well, should we, and my wife would say, do you think we should we give her some food? Should we go into the store here and buy her something and take her some food? Should we give her some money? And so the kids would say, yeah, I think we should, you know. And so then Lucia would say, why don't you take her our sandwich? So it wouldn't be Lucia saying, oh, no, let's be safe here, and I'll go over and hand her something. Just to kind of, no. She'd send our little kids, little tiny kids, walking over there to give this person something. And then you know what happened? Sometimes the person who got it would throw it in the street. And sometimes they'd thank you. But every time that happened, when our daughter or son came walking back, my wife would say, you're the greatest kid in the world. You're the greatest kid who ever lived. You're the sweetest kid for doing that. So you know what those kids think? They think, I want to do it again. I want to do it again. This is Aristotle about teaching people habits, rewarding them, praising them for the good things they do. And that exact same thing, maybe philosophers don't know what it's about, but people know what it's about, is when your employees do the right thing, when they show teamwork, you may not be able to give them a bonus, but you could certainly thank them for what they did and celebrate them in the company. And every time you do that, the rest of the people in the company, if you're authentic, the rest of the people in the company are going to say, I think I'd like to do some of that kind of thing. Because we're social animals. We live, you know, based on relationships and things like that. Now, some people are deeply wounded by life, and they don't respond immediately. But I think it is possible to build these things in organizations.
On that very nice summary, let's put our hands together again and thank David, please. We've been listening to David Gill talk to us about building ethically healthy organizations. And I want to thank you very much for some terrific insights. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.